Well, that
So
makes sense.
are you new to the Zooms, Don, or have you been here a while and I just you're on the other pages?
No, I'm new to Zoom.
Nice. Well,
I
welcome.
have a prison ministry in that we have. It's called Titus House Ministries.
Okay.
Yeah, we produce a newsletter out that we to 700 SO. I don't know what you call them here, but sex offenders or
Yeah, we
reformed
call them people forced to register.
people forced to register.
Because we don't, like if you killed someone when you were 20 and now you're 50, no one calls you a murderer,
Right.
right? So we don't believe in calling us the worst thing that's ever been done, especially when we know that most a lot of what's, what people are getting arrested for is just nonsense.
So what do you call them again?
People forced to register. We like to
Okay.
use person first language. And similarly, we don't like to use civil confinement. We call it shadow prisons because we think civil confinement is the worst. It's even worse than what they do to regular people.
Yeah,
Civil confinement
it's
is
crazy what they do about that.
just absolutely outrageous. It's clearly just, it's just a money-making scheme. And everybody who's on the registry starts to pretty quickly realize, oh, wait, this is just nonsense, isn't it? Because the countries that actually do a good job with the thing that they claim the registry is about do an entirely different thing than what we do here. They give them actual therapy and not fake therapy, and yeah, such nonsense.
Oh, okay.
Hey, Cully, you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, I've been here. I'm enjoying this. Thank you, Anne. And
You're
I was
welcome.
just th while you were talking, I was thinking, Guantanamo Bay. You know how ridiculous that was. What all those atrocities they did. That's what they're doing. This is the
That's what they're
modern Guantanamo. This is the acceptable Guantanamo Bay, you
Yeah, and
know.
it's acceptable because the way they've convinced everyone to see every one of us as the worst thing in the world. I had a conversation with a woman one time. She was like a friend of a friend. She showed up at a thing at the Botanical Garden with me. And I just sometimes can't help myself but talk about the registry because I feel
Thank
like
you.
We're on the right side of history and people just need to like hear our side, So anyway, I started talking about it and I think I was mostly talking to my friend, but she was there and so she heard us and she just immediately started saying, "Oh, this isn't what I know all about this." She acted like she was just the master of facts and claimed all these facts. She didn't really have facts. She just claimed like I know because I did the research on this when I was 20 or whatever. And pretty soon she was pretty much advocating that everyone on the registry, my partner included, should be castrated.
Oh,
And I was
jeez.
like, yeah, you're a four. We don't
Oh,
have to talk. I'm not going to convince you. And then after we left, she apologized to my friend and said to my friend, man, yeah, it's a good thing she, good thing that the thing ended and we got to walk out of there because I didn't actually have any facts.
jeez. You know, there's such a schizophrenia about all this too. You know how Britney Spears got really famous, even Bieber, because they acted like a child. You know, she was in high school, she was walking down through the lockers. One time I freaked out because there was a, this was like 10 years ago, it was a costume for a little girl that looked like the high school uniform, you know, where it's real short and they got a tie, which is what Britney wore. There is
Oh,
a
yeah.
constant drum of oversex things happening. It's
Of
schizophrenic.
course.
And then they nail some scapegoats.
Yeah.
Sickening.
Well, I mean, and the bottom line is, many, many countries and other societies like understand that you don't just switch, a switch doesn't turn from the day you're 17 and 364 days to 18 and one day. Like nothing, you learn your way up to that. And yeah.
I hear at different times they say what's worse. My son was just out of high school, and that's 23 years. He can't even go to a beach if there's a minor. He can't go to the library. He can't do shit. Ipso facto laws, they're all being broke. It's hysteria. And he got sent 5 years in prison for saying something. Saying something. Didn't have any
Yep.
lawyers. She knew he was on the sex offender list. The same judge got her judgment taken away because she gave it to an abusive father. And so her judgment was taken away. Don't tell me that narcissist, it wasn't sticking in her craw. So she went off on this rhetorical hyperbole with my son. And I know it was all because he was on the sex offender list. And instead of being a good judge, you know, compassion is a higher form of justice. Mm-hmm. She nailed his ass because she seen him coming so she could do this, all this grandstanding. All he did was say something stupid, sarcastic. I know it was weird, but it was private. It's kind of like, if you're not going to listen to me, well, what do I got to do? Drive by a school? Okay. But there was 72 pages of terrorism, one sentence on intent. They never proved intent. They never proved harm. It didn't go anywhere. He even retracted it. 5 years prison. And you know why he got that? Because he's on the sex offender list and she's an asshole.
Yep. Yep.
Plain and simple.
Yeah.
And I live in Dubuque, Iowa. They are nuts here. This is the holy land of milk and honey. Seven holy hills, little Rome, and they're nuts here.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and the fact is they're getting more and more greedy. You know, things are changing out in the world, and they can no longer just throw every brown person in prison for smoking weed. So now they're like, well, how are we going to fill up our prisons? So they're going to just.
Oh, you know what really ticks me off? They don't take a prisoner's address. It's gerrymandering. They don't the law and order people are the ones that put the prisons somewhere.
Yeah,
so
they take everybody
to vote. They don't want them to vote, but they want to.
They don't allow them to vote, but they get to count that address. The senatory. Yeah,
isn't
they get
that to count when they... It is really bad. I wonder if somebody from a foreign country was a real strong politician could get a hold of some of the stuff that's going on in the United States, because the people in the United States don't seem to care.
Yeah, we've lost our minds. We've just lost
absolutely.
Our minds.
Thank God for you. Thank God for your organization. I've decided this is very healthy for me to show up, because you people know how we feel. We know how
absolutely.
Each one feels, especially mothers.
Absolutely.
You know, in different countries, you'll see a mother holding
a
picture of their child. I'm 74. I'm an old hippie, so I'm losing it. You know, holding the picture of their child because they were taken away in a fascist country. I feel like going down to Main Street and holding the picture of my child. You know, maybe that's something we could organize. And we hold these pictures and they say, who are these? This is my son. 23 years in prison. Or you know, prison of their own mind.
23
now
years
he's sitting
old.
With 5 years for horse shit. And, you know, starting to tell our stories.
Yeah. Yeah. That's for sure a thing that we need to start to do. And, it's kind of on my list of things. We've got two meetings in January where we don't have a speaker lined up. And I'm thinking that maybe we turn it into a, you know, get somebody who can kind of like help us know what works and what doesn't work. Like when we were at our conference in Houston, one of the speakers was all about like, you know, how to get through to, you know, and there were different, he gave us different missions, you know, so some of us were like, you've got to get to, you know, somebody who's already kind of on your side, but you need to talk them into supporting this bill. And then someone else would be like, you need to get through to someone who's definitely not on your side and they're a senator and you need them to do this. And they basically, you know, kind of taught us that facts are not really what necessarily is going to win the day. What you got to do is you got to get them to agree with you on like, you know, a core issue, like, and you don't lead with, hey, you know, I'm supporting someone who's on the registry. You lead with something else, right? You know, you lead with, do you agree that after someone has served their time in prison, they should be able to, you know, reenter society and like do better? Well, you know what? I believe that too. And currently our system is the absolute opposite for the people on the registry. It's the absolute opposite. Anybody who's convicted of a crime that's related to sex, they're gonna lose their job, they're gonna lose their family, or they're probably not gonna have a large community to hang out with. We're gonna make it so that they cannot talk to people who have the same rules as them, you know, because felons aren't allowed to talk to other felons when they're on probation. And we're gonna make it hard for them to find a partner. And we're gonna basically just, you know, commit them to social, we're gonna give them social death. And then we're going to expect them to somehow do better. What? Oh, and we're going to make rules about where they can go and where they can stay and whether they can travel. We're basically going to just torture them for the rest of their lives. Yeah, it's the dumbest thing. Anyway, those 2 days in January, I was thinking of getting someone who can do a really good job explaining that, you know, method. and then just have us kind of practice, you know, give everybody like a, you know, a task. And then, you know, maybe people could put their, you know, it's really hard to go around the room and get to all 49 people. But that's one of the things I really love about the chat is that, you know, even if we've got a speaker speaking, people are typing like awesome, you know, they're making great points and saying great things. And, you know, how cool would it be if we could all kind of practice, you know, writing those kinds of comments in the chat. And then there's a way at the end, I don't know it, but Chuck always knows it. There's a way at the end to like save the chat. So, you know, if you missed like the, you know, that movie we should watch or that book we should read, or, you know, this awesome comment, there's a way to save it. All right. I see Galen has started us off with a, I think, there it is. He has just introduced himself. So if you want to introduce yourself in the chat, that would be amazing. We've got another 1 minute, but obviously more than 1 minute since we, oh wait, no, there's more people that I can't see. Hang on. Let me switch to the other view. All right. Oh, good. So our guy is here. All right. I'm going to squeeze this a little tighter and find my introductions there. And then it disappeared. There it is. All right. I don't usually start like exactly on the dot because, you know, people are not exactly on time. Can I continue to ask somebody a question? Is that all right with y'all? All right.
Okay, let me
find some names here that I haven't. Wanda, I believe you and I have either emailed or talked on the phone, but remind me. Let me unmute you.
Okay. Yes, we spoke on the phone. Well, no, we text. I'm sorry. We text about the Megan Walsh, and you asked my story, and we were similar in what we have gone through.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
My big question is, I would love to see an attorney on, because the reason why our guys are being thrown straight into jail is because the attorneys, our attorneys in our state, he admitted it. It's political suicide to defend a sex offender. And we had paid him all kind of money.
First, to register.
Yes. And well, now, yes, because of our governor, when he ran and was voted in, his main thing was lifetime registry for all sex offenders. And
wow.
Attorneys in our state couldn't defend because they had something that wasn't true against my son. And he went to court thinking he was going to be able to say, no, I want a jury trial.
Right. And the attorneys basically tell every one of us,
yes,
you're just wasting your money. But then they still take a bunch of our money. And sometimes they lie to us about nonsense.
And there was even a fund taken up by the businessmen of the city because they loved him and they gave it to this attorney. And it wasn't until the attorney and the DA had already gotten together and decided out a plea. And he was forced into the plea. And the attorney said, don't say a word, no matter what she says. Just say, no, no, no. I got your back. And when it was over, she said lifetime registration and 8 years.
Yeah. And
so anyway, I'm not going to take the floor too long. But anyway.
All right. So it is hard, but let's all try to remember to say, person forced to register. We want person-centered language. Okay. And it's hard because some of you have been on this registry for, you know, 30 years or whatever, but we want to use language that works for us. You know, and the best explanation that I ever heard somebody say was, if someone is, you know, gets out of jail, they serve whatever years for committing murder. When they get out 30 years later, nobody calls them murderers, right? They're a person who was in jail 30 years ago, and every other bad thing people do, they're allowed to get forgiveness and return to society and try to do better, except for us. Oh, talk to Amnesty International folks in Europe. They might be willing to attack what the U.S. is doing. What a brilliant idea. All right. A brilliant idea. Okay. I think we are, is 2 minutes good enough? Can I introduce our speaker? Okay, good. And it seems like we've gone from one page to three pages pretty recently. All righty. Okay, so Dr. Ira Katz, do you want to say something so they know who we're introducing while I introduce you?
Yes, it's Jean Ira Katz, but yes, that's me.
Well, you are a doctor though, right?
I am a doctor.
Yeah, so Dr. Ira Katz is not totally unusual.
Yeah, except Ira is my middle name is what I'm saying.
Oh, okay, Dr. Katz. Okay, got it. Anyway.
Okay.
This is Dr. Ira Katz. He is a mental health counselor specializing in sex therapy. He's a prolific author who also holds a doctorate of management degree in criminal justice. Dr. Katz has been teaching as an associate professor at Colorado Technical University since 2011. He's the creator of Sex Crimes, Behavior and Consequences, one of the first such university courses of its kind in the U.S. He is also considered a subject matter expert on sexually based offenses and has been invited to speak on such issues before government and agency leaders. In addition, Dr. Katz has provided therapeutic interventions in jails, prisons, group homes, and psychiatric facilities, and he has been awarded citations from both the U.S. Congress and the New York State Legislature for achievements in community mental health. With hundreds of published articles to his name, Dr. Katz is also a regular contributor to Behavioral Health News and American Police Beat magazine, and he has presented before numerous professional organizations, including the Academy of Criminal Justice Sciences, the American Society of Criminology, and the American Academy of Sexuality Counselors, Sexuality Educators, Counselors, and Therapists. Boy, that's a long name, among many others.
We call it ASECT, but okay.
You call it ASECT?
ASECT.
American Academy of Sexual Educators. Huh, I didn't even know there was such thing. In this meeting, Dr. Katz plans to discuss the lack of evidence-based practice in treatment for those convicted of sexually based offenses. Anyway, that's what he's talking about, so I'm not going to say anymore. We'll let him tell us the rest of it.
Thank you for the introduction. I appreciate it. For those of you who have been around for a while, I was here about 2 years ago for two different occasions, and I very much look forward to coming back. A lot of water under the bridge in the past 2 years. The other thing I plan to discuss today is a subject that's gaining a lot of momentum, which is the idea of a DSM diagnosis of compulsive sexual behavior disorder. So I'm going to talk about that as well. And somebody named Ken, who I haven't seen here, I looked on all the little windows and I didn't see Ken.
He often does not come.
Okay. Ken sent a couple of articles that he thought should be discussed here. And I looked them over and I'm okay with discussing the articles that he brought up. Now, I see that somebody does not want a DSM diagnosis of compulsive sexual behavior disorder. And I'm going to make the case for why it should be. And I'm okay if you're opposed to it. That's fine.
He'll be opposed to it, and then he'll teach you a bunch of smart things.
I hope so. I hope so. But let's start off with, you know, my primary reason for being here, why I got involved with the war room in the first place, and et cetera. I'm a sex therapist. I work with individuals who have problems with their sexuality. You know, that's a whole range of things. Some of them skirt the edge of legal behavior. A lot of them have to do with compulsive sexuality. And sometimes it's just dealing with couples who are having problems in the bedroom and that kind of stuff, or people questioning their own gender identity and et cetera, et cetera. So, and as you will see from the presentation I'm going to show you, once a person has been arrested, I will still work with them up until the point where the judge bangs the gavel. Once the judge bangs the gavel, they are then within the correctional system. And I have determined I am not going to work within the correctional system. I'm not going to, you know, go into the prison or be a contracted psychotherapist on the outside for the reasons I'm going to explain going forward. So now, if they'll let me, I will continue to work with any clients after they've been incarcerated. But the way it's set up in Colorado, that's not likely. You have to be a contracted counselor with the Sex Offender Management Board, which is a statewide board of providers. Most of the providers in the state, several hundred, are private practitioners with their own practice, as I have, who have some kind of contracted arrangements with the state. There are a couple of dozen who work within the prison system. There's a huge complex here in Colorado called Canyon City, and that's primarily where people who have been convicted of sexual offenses winds up. And by the way, that's, I believe, the person-centered language I like to use, is that persons who have been convicted of sexual offenses. And I noticed, I'm not going to be looking at all the chats, but I noticed one chat box popped up. Most states have almost zero programs. They're essentially correctional programs. They're not even counseling on any level whatsoever. However, every state does have some kind of program, and I'll get to that in the second half. But let's start off with this. My doctoral dissertation, I'm going to show you this in a second. Let me get the right thing. Share screen. And boom. Hopefully you can see this. Can everybody see this? It says Managerial Improvements. The Colorado Sex Offender Management Board, or the SOMB, needs to support evidence-based practices in offender treatment. Can everybody see that? Okay. This was my dissertation. It's 170 pages. Took 3 years. And it stands up pretty well. I'm actually in the process of converting it to a book that people could just sit and read without it being a dissertation, which is a very formal presentation. So now the heart of this report, and that's the ProQuest there, is the cover of my dissertation. And it is available on ProQuest and ResearchGate. And if anybody has any problem accessing any of those, if you want to see it, I'll be glad to connect you. So the heart of the matter is, what is evidence-based practice? Evidence-based practice is very specific. It is different than the term best practices. Best practices can be all over the place. Best practices is usually what they do. Well, that's not how we do it here. That's how we do it there. And by the way, I didn't mention, and I didn't put it in the bio that I told you, I'm also a licensed addiction counselor. So on top of everything else. So I have a view of what places do when they're practicing, and where is the evidence based, and where is it kind of like, quote, best practices, like that's how we do it here. Evidence-based practice is very specific, requires these three circles. Clinical expertise, that means the practitioner has to have the level of expertise, training, research, and that includes continuing education, because this field is always evolving. So if somebody, you know, got their license 30 years ago and never took a new class, their clinical expertise is questionable at best. That's number one. Plus 30 years ago was the DSM-3. We're up to the DSM-5 TR, and soon will be the DSM-6. The other thing that's required is scientific evidence. You need backup for any kind of practice. If you're going to do a therapeutic intervention, it has to be backed up by science. And by science, I mean science which backs up its therapeutic value, not its correctional value, not its value that the courts recognize. The courts are irrelevant. Corrections is irrelevant in terms of evidence-based practice, unless they are supporting this. Scientific evidence is woefully missing in this whole process, as probably a lot of you have already found out. And the other is client individuality. Now, that gets tricky. You're talking about people who've been convicted of a crime. Once somebody is convicted of a crime, the system, in a sense, takes over. So how are you going to have client individuality? Well, one way to have client individuality is that if you're going to have a counseling program, how about you address the needs of that particular client? It's not a one size fits all. And in many of the programs that are out there, it is exactly that, is a one size fits all. In fact, the intake form, okay, so as a psychotherapist, I have an intake form. I'm going to check off boxes based on what that client is telling me. That's what we do. That's what evidence-based practice is, also person-centered practice, which is what I do. It's called Rogerian. In the correctional system, they use something called the static 99. Static 99 is a risk assessment. Okay, now how many people here think that I sit down and do a risk assessment with my client the first time I meet them? Anybody? We see any hands? No, probably not. Oh, you think I do a risk assessment? You're a joker. I can see that. See that in your eye. No, of course I don't do a risk assessment with my clients. That has nothing to do with doing therapy for somebody. I do a diagnostic workup. You know, what's going on with that person, with that individual? What happened? You know, why are they there? What can we do to help? That's what we're there for. Therapy is a helping process, not a punitive process. And all too often when the system takes over, of course it's a punitive process. Now, many times, and I found this out in Colorado, which is considered one of the premier states for sex offender management. Okay, that's their term, by the way, and I'm going to use it. I would use a different term, but that's what it is. It is considered one of the premier states, and it is still correctional. That's just the way it is. And considering that this is one of the best, you can imagine what some of the other states are doing. And I've looked at some of the other states. I'm working with one of the states on the East Coast right now. They've been working 4 years trying to develop a reasonable evidence-based program, and it's almost impossible. One of the reasons being probation and parole winds up having a major role in driving the whole thing. I don't work with probation and parole. They have nothing to do with my profession. Zero. They are correctional people. That's law enforcement and corrections. That is not counseling. So in that yellow box on the lower right, evidence-based practice in the field of psychotherapy is a specific protocol. It's not a description that defines the standards of care for psychotherapeutic intervention as detailed in the official policy statements of the American Psychological Association, the American Psychiatric Association, and other organizations, including the National Institute of Corrections. They also want evidence-based practice to be used where it is supposed to be used. Now, we can have a whole debate about the correctional system and whether it works or not for anybody, anywhere. It's a punitive system. That's what it is. So that's just part of the reality that we have to deal with going forward. So now in Colorado, when the SOMB was first developed, here's the language in the Colorado statutes. The SOMB shall determine the effectiveness of treatment policies through a comprehensive review of evidence-based practices. That's what the lawmakers said. So I went ahead and did a three-year study, and I found that, we'll get to all the findings. But let's talk about the legal responses and punishments, largely reflecting commonly held misperceptions and groundless stereotypes. And then I'll get to what my findings were in the study, which you can imagine. So here's myths about sex offenders. These were established. These are facts. This isn't somebody's opinion. These were established by Fedorov in the 90s. Fedorov was the top forensic psychologist who worked with people convicted of sex offenders in Canada, in the nation of Canada. And nobody has ever been able to assail his findings. And these are the five top on the list. So sex offenders must suffer from certain mental disorders. Not true. They cannot be cured. Well, if the first isn't true, then the second doesn't make any sense, does it? They all require mental and behavioral treatment. They are well practiced in their signature crimes. How about that concept of signature crimes? Now, there are serial offenders. That is a fact. And some serial offenders do have, what would you say, characteristic behaviors in their crimes. That's a whole other story. That's a whole criminology discussion. It's not so much a discussion of people who have specifically been busted for sexual offenses. And five, they are more dangerous than other kinds of criminals. There's zero evidence for any of these things. So these are just five of a long list of things that Fedorov found out, but I focused on these five because I thought they spoke to the whole correctional mentality, the legal, judicial, correctional mentality. So how about recidivism rate? Well, it's like 99%. Oh, yeah? So as of 2015, which is when I got these, dissertation is a few years old, but this was the latest data I could find at the time. But I've looked at it since, and the numbers are still extremely close. So it's about 13% for people who have undergone treatment, and it's about 17% for people who have not undergone treatment. That's the recidivism rate. Anybody know the recidivism rate for people busted for assault? Anybody just speak up? Okay. It's 40 to 60%. Okay. So where are the programs for the people who have been busted for assault? Anybody hear of any? And there may be some out there, but they haven't been legislated. I can almost guarantee you that. So in 2017, one of the Supreme Court justices offhandedly said that people who commit sexual offenses have an 80% recidivism rate. There's nothing to back that up whatsoever. They were just speaking off the top of their head, and it became part of judicial canon. It was the Supreme Court. It was during session. And so courts across the country just parroted that. And this is the official tale is that people who have been convicted of sexual offenses have an 80% recidivism rate, which is not so. Some individuals might, and we'll get to that later. Now, how about stranger danger? That's why there's a SORNA. If it wasn't for stranger danger and the whole fear of stranger danger, SORNA would not exist. SORNA is a response to one specific terrible tragedy, actually two. And that's a whole other story. We could spend the whole hour talking about that. But the majority of sexual assaults are by persons known to their victims, vast majority. Some numbers go as high as 90%. So the whole rhyme and reason for Sona makes absolutely no sense whatsoever, but I think everybody here already knows that. But this is one big reason why. What are we doing with this thing? It's ruining people's lives for what reason? What's the point? And then the registration effectiveness, it does not prevent crimes. People who are driven to commit the crimes are going to commit the crimes whether on the registry or not. They do not deter crimes, and they certainly do not help the survivors. There seems to be no point to SORNA at all, except for some kind of public relations, people running for office, judges want to bang their gavel, whatever it is. It makes no sense whatsoever. Now, I got to tell you, when I went into this, I didn't know about all these ins and outs. My field was psychotherapy. And then I got into becoming an expert in criminal justice. And this was the end of that road. And that's a whole long story. I'm not going to get into it, but I was given the opportunity to go for this doctorate. So I started researching. I didn't know anything about this. I knew nothing. It wasn't an area of interest of mine. I wasn't going to go work in the prison. So what's going on out there? So when I started to find out all this, it's like, oh, it's a scam, period. Now, are there bad people out there doing bad things? Yes. And I've always said, and I want to make it very clear, there are cases I've heard and people I've met, and I'm perfectly fine if you lock them up and throw away the key. There are bad people out there. That doesn't mean that everybody who has been convicted of a sexual offense belongs on this registry or is to be treated as some kind of pariah and monster. There are much, much, much more terrible people regularly going in and out of jail who should never be let out, who beat people up, who cause terrible damage to people's lives. That's a whole other discussion. Polygraphs and polygraphs, they use them everywhere. They're the coin of the realm. Evidence-based, duh. I think everybody here probably knows that. The accuracy of polygraphs as reported in the scientific literature was low at best, and its validity is academically controversial, and it's like something out of Orwell's 1984. And that was a opinion from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. I wish more judges would speak out about this. Now, substantial data indicating the inclusion of polygraph devices as used are not scientifically valid. After nearly 2 year scientific research review on polygraph examinations to determine their validity and polygraph reliability, over 100 years of scientific research in psychology and physiology offers almost no basis to expect a polygraph to test to provide very high accuracy. And now the plethysmograph, I did a lot of research on the plethysmograph. And the thing is, plethysmograph does what it's supposed to do. But how do you interpret the numbers? That's the question on the floor. Why is it being used? Does anybody not know what a plethysmograph is? I can't see your hands being raised. In case you don't know, it is a device that's put on a male penis to measure the blood flow when they're showed certain pictures or read certain literature, et cetera, as though that is supposed to be able to be interpreted to mean something. There is no scientific basis for that. The plethysmograph does measure blood flow, just as it's supposed to. But the idea of coming up with some kind of meaning for the amount of blood that's flowing, it's junk science. There's nothing to back it up that is evidence-based, not a thing. And I examined this at the doctoral level. It's pretty thorough. So let me be clear that none of this stuff is my opinion. I mean, I do have opinions, clearly, but the stuff you're seeing here is not my opinions. Like, this is the facts. So 5 key findings from the study. Most of the providers that I interviewed were unable to describe what evidence-based practice are. These are people who are practicing psychotherapists in the state of Colorado, who've been hired by the state to work with this population. They do not know what evidence-based practice means. One of them did. The SMB does not provide any trainings about evidence-based practice. It's not within their vocabulary. And if you look at like their bylaws, it's not in there. There's nothing about it. Client characteristics and preferences have practically no relevance, which makes no sense to me at all. What about cultural differences? What about ethnic differences? What about differences in how people were raised, class, experiences? Those are very relevant to dealing with a client, no matter what their crime was. It's like they are individual human beings who have, their own story. That is essential in psychotherapy. That's evidence-based. So before I referred to it as client preferences, that also means client characteristics. Who is that person? They're not just, oh, well, they're one of them. They're and they'll give them some kind of letters after their name. S.O., whatever. They're an S.O., so they go, wait a minute. That's not who they are. It's what they've been charged with. Doesn't mean that's who they are. Therapy is almost impossible within a correctional system. Correctional system is run by the correctional system. It's not run by therapists. Now, Fedorov up in Canada had a unique opportunity to, let us say, use his power and his characteristics. He was well known up there. So he was able to devise a lot of new programs and stuff. That's not happening here in the United States, isn't it? We don't have a Fedorov. What I heard was stuff like one of the clients was, and I call them clients, by the way, one of the clients, I don't know, didn't go make their bed or whatever it was, some infraction of the rules. And so they were locked in a special housing unit for a month. Nobody told the therapist. Therapist was just like, what happened to Jack? Oh, well, he won't be back for another month. Therapist has nothing to say about it, wasn't at all advised or consulted, which I think would make sense to me. That doesn't work. So if I'm working with a client and they suddenly drop off the radar for 4 weeks, that interferes with the process, especially if it's out of their control. It wasn't their choice. And some people, they want to take a break, or some people, they want to stop. It's too much for them, whatever. That's their choice, not some probation officer or corrections officer deciding, all right, you go in the shoe, that's it. Providers of, you know, therapy for folks who have been convicted of sexual offenses have almost no formal training about the criminal justice system. So in other words, these individuals who are the clients are stuck in a milieu that the counselor has no understanding of what the day-to-day is like in a prison. It's not like living in the world. It just ain't. It's this whole other world. And they have no training in it whatsoever. How are they going to deal with the needs of their clients if they don't understand it at all? You better believe my private clients, I will sit and talk with them about their jobs. What do they do in their jobs? So they'll tell me, well, they work in a school. Well, what do you do there? You know, what's your day like? You know, it tells you a lot about an individual to know what their environment is like, what their world is like. And so now the SOMB does trainings every year at their annual conference. They've had no trainings about evidence-based practice and no trainings about the criminal justice system at all, ever. Okay, it's been in existence since 2009. So most SOMB plans are designed to be punitive and correctional. Under the rules of jurisprudence, outside the normally ethical and practical code of conduct for psychotherapy, the law demands that all sex offenders participate in mandated treatment programs, while the research indicates that there is quite a wide diversity of offender types, behaviors, motives, and levels of self-awareness, which suggests that a more eclectic approach could be more effective than one size fits all. Now, that said, remember the numbers I told you before. We're talking about a 13 to 17% recidivism rate, which is very mild in terms of the recidivism rates among people who have been incarcerated. That's a low number. I'm not saying it's irrelevant, but its relevance has to be taken into context. So you have a population that the vast majority will only commit that one crime. That's it. And then their lives are in the system forever. There's no other crime that does that, not even murder. There's no other crime where somebody's in the system forever in one form or another, or have, you know, they call it, you know, putting a bell on the cat with the SORNA, with the registry. It's like, what? There's no registry for people who beat up other people. Why not? Anyway. Okay, so before the contemporary era of sex offender management, or SOM, which began in the late 20th century, law enforcement and the criminal justice system has long grappled with the aberrance and perversity of sexually based offenses. Now, over time, the general public has come to hold a set of beliefs about this type of criminal, mostly based upon stereotypes, fears, myths, media misconceptions, and misunderstandings. And I'll tell you, one of the worst offenders on this one is Law and Order SUV, or SVU. Yeah, SVU. I read some research about that one program. Basically, 70% of the stories are the same story over and over. And that same story that they use over and over is based on myths, misunderstandings, misperceptions. So they keep kind of selling a story that this is what somebody who's committed a sex offense is like. And it's, you know, there may be individuals who are like that, but the vast majority are not. And here's this one program that millions of people watch every week for decades now, and don't think that hasn't had an effect on social consciousness. So more commonly held fallacies. They always lie to avoid treatment. They are sex maniacs, whatever exactly that means. And I'll talk about that more in a little bit. Notification of their whereabouts protects society. There is absolutely no proof of that whatsoever. No proof. I mean, even somebody who was a violent sexual offender, the fact that they're on the registry does not protect society. They are all depraved men who suffered childhood abuse themselves. So now that may be the case with individuals. Maybe individuals who went through terrible times as young people and were abused themselves, and they are living out the scars of their youth. They should never be allowed to masturbate. That's a widely held belief. And it's ironclad in prisons. Oh my goodness. They'll come down really hard if they find out that somebody is taking care of themselves. They have too much testosterone. They cannot be cured. Well, the fact of the matter is the vast majority of people who have been convicted of sexual offenses do not have a mental health disorder. So what are we talking about that cannot be cured? Everybody could use help, whether you have a diagnosis or not. A sex offender is a sex offender is a sex offender. So these are some commonly held fallacies. And I'm not sure, let me check my other slide. Here we go, community mental health advocates, professional treatment providers and other concerned individuals have the opportunity to positively influence SOM regulations by promoting evidence-based practices and revealing lapses to the public and lawmakers. So I don't know how many people here have gone to your state legislature. Almost all state legislatures in this country allow public testimony. And if you can't get down there, they almost all have text testimony or video testimony. You could do it at home via Zoom. That's one of the ways that I testified four times before the General Assembly. Three times I went there myself because I thought it was more effective to sit there in front of these folks. And one time I testified by video, and that was just as effective, actually. So contact organizations such as ASACT or SASH, which is the Society for the Advancement of Sexual Health, for current information about cutting-edge evidence-based SOM treatment approaches. ASAC is a great organization, very far forward-thinking, and so is SASH. Learn detailed strategies through UN Women and their many successful legislation campaigns over the year. UN Women, if you look up their website, will lay out all these, how to do public campaigns to change, you know, get articles in the paper, get on the local news, all that kind of stuff. And blog, podcast, cable television, which is still a thing, YouTube, reach out and find allies, connections, and interested citizens willing to engage with legislators and policymakers. With that, I'm going to stop sharing. So I have a second part, but let me stop here because the second part is a little bit different. And let me open it to questions. I can't see you all, so I suggest you either, maybe Anne, you can moderate, or whoever speaks out first, you get to ask the question.
Oops, I forgot to unmute myself. I just said a whole bunch
of words. I noticed that, yeah.
Everybody notice that down in the bottom where it says, where is it gone on my screen? Reactions, I believe it's called. Yeah, reactions. If you click on reactions, one of the choices is raise your hand. So before anyone raises their hand, there is a lot of great stuff in this chat. And obviously you weren't paying a whole lot of attention to the chat because you were busy.
No, talking. I didn't view the chat at all.
There's a lot of good stuff in the chat, but I see John's had his hand up, which is perfect because now I can go read the chat while John's asked his question.
Yeah. And if you see anything in the chat that I should respond to, please bring it up.
Dr. Katz, good evening.
Good evening.
Oh, wait a second. Let me give you an idea as to who you're talking to. I can. There we go.
All right. Let me, I got it.
Okay.
I got to hear you over here. Okay, I see you.
Okay. Actually, I've got two things. I don't know how much you will address them or have or what, but two things. Early this year, I testified before the Arkansas State Legislature about a sex offense-related bill. And much to their shock, the State Department of Corrections verified what I've been telling them about low recidivism rates. But they gave me an argument that almost all of us have heard again and again and again. And I'd like to get, and this is my first thing, I would like to get your response to some of these tropes that they come up with. And the one that they did, well, even if it saves one child. So that's one thing I'd like for you to maybe respond to. The other particular interest to me and to several other people would be the trauma, the damage, the results of someone who is falsely accused and has to go through all and more of what you've been talking about. So those are two points. Those are two issues that I would very, very greatly appreciate your responding to.
So let me respond to the first one first. I'll mention it that I was contacted because I go to a lot of conferences, and I was contacted by the Maryland Department of Corrections Division of Parole Probation, who've been trying to develop an enlightened SOM program for years. They've been working on it for 4 years. And I met with them so far 3 times. And there's going to be this eternal battle between the correctional folks, like that band of people, legislators who think they're going to get more votes if they're, you know, whatever, tough on crime, whatever it is. This is my understanding, and this is what I've been doing with Maryland. And they already know that something's wrong. They came to me and said, aren't polygraphs inadmissible in courts? I said, yes, they are. Yeah, it's a good question, you know. So why are they being routinely used in sex offender management? It's like, that's the whole thing. It's like, it's topsy-turvy.
Because they're charging people money every time they do it and paying someone's salary?
That's part of it.
Could that be why?
That's part of it, absolutely. Well, they found out in Colorado, I'm sorry, and I will answer your question. In Colorado, they found out that two of the members on the sex offender management board had relatives who had polygraph companies. Yeah, they were busted by the state auditors, by the way. That was on the sex offender management board. So anyway, that
what state was that?
That's in Colorado. All
right.
Yeah, there was an audit done in 2020, I believe, state audit of the sex offender management board in particular. And that was just one of their findings. So, but anyway, the best we can do is to educate them with the evidence, with the actual science. Bring the science, put it forward as best you can. I think that's our best suit, is to say, well, here's the numbers. So the idea, well, even if it saves one child, it says that, well, that doesn't really address the argument. That's over there. That's your argument. That's not the argument I'm raising. The second about, you know, people who have been falsely accused, and we'd have to, you know, have some kind of agreement, but anybody who's been falsely accused of a serious crime is going to go through some kind of trauma, you know, depending on the outcome of, you know, where does it stop, or if somebody's actually falsely convicted, you know, from my point of view as a counselor, they're going to need some serious help somewhere down the line, and I hope they get it. So in terms of what can we do about it, this is a situation where it's almost impossible to do anything. There's so much that's out of our hands. You got the system, capital S. So you're talking about the law enforcement and the correctional system. This is a monolith that's tough to do much about. Best you can do is work at the legislative end, number one. That's why I say go to your state houses. Work with the actual individuals who are creating the laws. That's where you're going to actually start to make some difference.
We've also got to convince our peers, because the lawmakers say, oh, we're on your side. We agree this is a waste of money. But like, they let the genie out of the bottle. Yeah. And now all the people that are voting for them think, you know, whatever they were told in the 90s, and nobody believe, you know, nobody's willing to put it away.
Yeah. Well, that also requires then public relations campaigns and that kind of stuff, which is a bit of a shift. Just ironically, my earlier career was in media. I was a radio and television producer and news broadcaster and all that stuff. And there are ways to use the media to get your message across.
Yeah, so we need to start doing that too.
But
all right, we have a hand up.
Personal relationships with the movers and shakers is going to go a long way to change things, especially if you can get to judges, because they're usually on the bench forever. So.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah. Do you want me to call, or do you want you?
I'm going to call on Ann.
Hi, Ann.
Oh, hang
You're
on.
Muted. You're okay now.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I am, interestingly enough, here from Maryland, and I am director of advocacy of a group called Prepare. We work with people who are going up for parole and support them through their reentry.
Okay.
So one of the reason that I'm here is to find out how to help transform this system in the state of Maryland, which is very interesting. You just mentioned, because I have been kind of going around and making inquiries and trying to develop an actual action plan to help my clients. So right. I am hoping that either we can connect at some point,
yes,
or tell me what we're doing in Maryland so that I can join the effort rather than kind of create my own effort, which may not be cohesive.
Absolutely. I'll just give you my email address right now. Just anybody, you're welcome to give it.
I'll type it in there right now.
Okay, thank you. So it's Jean Ira Katz, one word, all lowercase, @yahoo.com.
Oops.
And
I sent it to just Galen.
Next to me. It looks like I see your hand raised from Richard.
Yep. The next one I see is Richard. Yep. Go to it, Richard.
Thanks.
Hi, Richard. Can't see you, but that's okay.
Right. I'm with an organization that we're really focused on the treatment end of things, the mental health and behavioral treatments.
Okay.
And I've really been concerned about just the very things you've been talking about, how the treatment is totally different from treatments that would be given to any other kind of person, whether they've violated a law or not. And what really bothers me is these treatments are also used on juveniles. And I've looked at the Colorado guidelines and standards for juvenile treatment. It's very heavily based on polygraph. And what I'm wondering about is whether it would be productive to talk with the people that lead ATSA. Are you familiar with ATSA?
Okay, my first response is probably not. ATSA is, they have their heels dug in, unfortunately. Now, that's my perspective, okay? I've tried to approach them a bunch of times. What can I say? They seem to me to be more correctionally oriented than therapeutically oriented, unfortunately.
Well, I'm sort of in the middle of conversations with David Prescott, who is a former president of ATSA, and he's now at Safer Society. And Safer Society also advocates these same kind of treatment approaches.
Yeah.
And he's sent me some articles from about 10 years ago, 8 or 10 years ago, studies that he did on people that went through these treatments, and they gave glowing reports on how good the treatment was and how they felt it was very helpful. And I don't doubt that some people would find it helpful, but I'm just wondering how honest those people can be when they're taking those things, when they're doing those surveys. And I guess I was just wondering if so the ATSA people claim, and David Prescott claims to be a helping professional who's concerned about all the right things, the welfare and the autonomy of the client. But of course, I'm just wondering if he's being very political and just talking one way there, and then he's part of the system. But ATSA seems to be promoting a lot of these containment models, what they're using on juveniles in Colorado.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for raising that issue. Now, that's
Richard, lot of people are asking, what's the name of your organization?
Oh, Before You Act.
I've heard you guys talk.
Okay.
Somewhere.
And we are based in Maryland, by the way.
Ah, okay. You know, I have a really good feeling about my work in Maryland, so maybe we all can do something, us folks here who have a connection with Maryland. Yeah, I have a very good feeling about it because they're open to listening. That's the thing that I was impressed by. All right, so let me address what you're saying here. I have to be careful because ATS is not my cup of tea. I'm a Rogerian practitioner. I'm person-centered. It's all about me holding up a mirror to somebody to help them see themselves better. That's what I do as a counselor. And that's one of the reasons why I could not work in the correctional system. They won't let me do that. But the numbers do show improvement in people who have received treatment, even ATSA-based treatment. So that's just something to reckon with. The numbers do show improvement. It's not dramatic. It's not a huge shift. You know, it's not like an earthquake, but it's significant. And so I can't just write off their protocol. I wish they would have a further open mind about what to do out there, but they're not you know, I want to see proponents of evidence-based practice. And they consider that their numbers prove that since that system works, that's evidence-based. And I think that's cooking the books, as far as I'm concerned, because we don't have any other system. You know, all we have is the one that is the correctional way of doing therapy. The thing is, it does move the needle. So that's a fact. I looked at the recent numbers, but it's not huge. It's not huge significant, you know. But then again, you know, we're talking about a population. We're talking about a prison population, a relatively small group in a larger group. So there's a whole lot of issues here to unpack. But, you know, they're, you know, I love the group ASECT. I've been to their conferences as well. It's a very forward-looking group. But they are also kind of reticent to adapt certain forward-thinking concepts as well. So, you know, unfortunately, that's my take on ATSA. But they're here to stay. That's one thing about ATSA. They're not going anywhere, and they're the main professional organization in this field. So we're going to have to reckon with them. Best we can do is to try to get in there and change their minds.
Galen, you had your hand up, but now it's down.
Stop.
Don't stop. Okay.
So, yeah, can you guys hear me? Can you hear me?
Who am I hearing?
Galen.
Okay, Galen.
So, Galen Volfman, Just Future Project. I'm directly impacted. I've been incarcerated for 14 years altogether. I was a Soros Justice Fellow and done a lot of other rather impressive things. I want to sort of help you out here and address the ATSA issue, because I, you know, can say what I really believe, and ATSA is just whoring themselves to law enforcement. That is what they are about. That's where their money comes from. That's their agenda. And I could say this because I have met with the last five presidents of the organization. And I asked them about the containment model, which was developed in Colorado, of all places, by Kim English in the 90s. So we have Colorado to thank for this idea that we should, quote unquote, contain the offender with the use of fake treatment, law enforcement, and polygraphy. They are just compliance programs. They are not therapeutic. The patient is not the client. The client is law enforcement, yes, which is what we or what used to be called in the therapeutic professions unethical. And people are making a vast amount of money doing this, and they have absolutely no interest in changing how they think about this. So I'm actually, I would disagree with Dr. Katz on the idea that it's possible, even remotely possible in this universe, to work with ATSA. They are paid to believe what they believe. They're paid a lot to believe it. And it's one of, frankly, the reasons that our community has been screwed for so many years, because there's very little resources, then I'll step down from my soapbox. There are very little resources that go into supporting advocacy around sex-related policy issues. You know, the ACLU doesn't really work on this. They don't have policy positions on the civil rights for, you know, registries or international Megan's Law or any of the sort of big civil rights issues of our day. And at the same time, there are these big trade associations where the people who are on the other side are getting paid bank to believe what they believe. The other thing that I would just sort of offer very briefly is ATSA runs around, I mean, their flag is evidence-based policy, right? They claim that everything that they believe is evidence-based. Of course, they occasionally change what is evidence-based. So for example, many of your loved ones, or maybe people here that are on the registry, have been subjected to the so-called sex offense history polygraph, or maybe two separate concepts of the sexual history polygraph. Well, let me try this again. Sexual history, which is like them forcing you to tell you your sexual history, and then they polygraph you on it. So I think of it as like one thing, but maybe you think of it as separate. Now the field says, oh, the evidence-based policy is that we shouldn't do this to people. It doesn't work and it's harmful. But then for the last 25 years, they've said that this was evidence-based policy and was so important and it was the most important thing. And we should lock you up if you don't like comply. So that's my TED Talk on ATSA. Thanks, Anne.
Thank you. No, all right, Sandy, you are next.
By the way, Anne, how long do we go?
8:30. So we have another 26 minutes, which should be enough for them to ask a bunch more questions, and then maybe to even continue talking.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
I do have another section I wanted to bring up, but I don't want to curtail anybody's questions. Go ahead. Sandy, I'm listening.
All right, Sandy, you're up.
Okay. Hi. Hi. I'm sitting here with my husband, Greg, served about 32 months, and now he's home since May, and he is, yay.
Thank you so much.
He's now doing his court ordered treatment. He went in and we're in Oregon.
Okay.
Oregon, in central Oregon. And it's been really an eye opener. You know, there was no assessment when he went in. There was no intake. She just started treating him. Basically, for a while there, she was treating him for anxiety, and that was it. And he now is facing his full disclosure polygraph, which
they were just talking.
You guys were just talking about. He's already done a maintenance polygraph, and I posted a link to antipolygraph.org, which has a plethora of great information for people who are convicted of sex offenses, you know, and how to basically beat these polygraphs, because they're just punitive. His therapist has been saying, oh, this isn't punitive. I don't care about that other stuff. I'm here to treat you. She said, you know, she's always claimed that everything is evidence-based, which, you know, we have yet to see that. She's done no risk assessment. She hasn't done a risk assessment. She's done no assessment. So he doesn't have any timeline of when he gets, you know, to graduate. He has no idea what this person is asking of him, basically. It's just been really a interesting experience. And we have to pay for it.
A lot.
So it's not something I wish on anybody, but it's, you know, you can't get out of it because it's court ordered. And she's quick to say that. Last week he met with her. He meets with her once a month. She doesn't need him in group or anything. And she got angry at him for asking, you know, what's the end goal? What, you know, when do I graduate? What tier am I at? And she just got mad and yelled at him.
Because they're making money off of you. They're not going to let you out.
Yes.
Yep. They're not going to let you out until they have someone to fill your spot.
Yeah, I was told to watch my mouth. I'm walking on thin ice. Watch my tone and how I'm asking things.
So
that sucks.
I've already done a psychosexual evaluation with one of the top doctor, Dr. Davis, here in the state of Oregon. And he had already found me, and this was a psycho eval that I've done myself, that I paid for myself, that had nothing to do with courts or anything else. And basically, after all this, he looked across the desk at me and said, what the F are you doing here? You're more normal than anybody I've ever seen. Why are you here? How did this happen? What's going on? And I looked at him and says, you tell me, doc. And so I would like to just put this off my therapist, my person giving treatment, as what is the end goal of all this besides just, as been stated, the
money,
and it's the cookie cutter approach. One size fits all. You're in the grinder. You go through, you have to say what they want to hear you say, fill out the paperwork they want you to fill it out, and try to get you to confess to some other crime at some earlier date, especially when nothing had ever happened. And so I don't really.
And any advice on how to handle this?
Oh, that's a big question. I mean, what you're saying is it's standard fare, what you're saying. I mean,
yeah.
This is what's going on out there. That's why I speak out about this from my perspective as a professional in the field, although I don't work with the correctional system. But in terms of advice of how to handle it, it would require finding an actual therapist that you can work with.
Yeah.
And just don't let them know about each other, you know, because it sounds to me like you could use help from a competent counselor to navigate this. I mean, this is like an existential nightmare is what it is.
Yeah,
it is. It's walking on a minefield of eggshells.
It is. It is.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And so, after this, I got berated by this person after she told me, oh, feel free to talk about or bring up anything you can. And this is a safe place for you to go ahead and talk about whichever you wish.
Yeah, that's a pro forma statement for a controlled situation. But see, from where I sit, that right there is reportable.
Reportable?
In other words, we have a state board that all licensed practitioners have to respond to. And there's a process for the public to, it's called a grievance. So anybody from the public can grieve their counselor and say, he called me a name, you know, and didn't like what I said, and, you know, called me a son of a bitch, and, you know, I didn't like that, and he didn't apologize, and I want him brought up before you guys on a grievance. I don't know if you have that in your state. I really don't know.
What's that?
But in any case, that's despicable.
Yeah.
For a counselor to do that is absolutely against all ethics of counseling. That person,
and I've heard her treat other people as well. I know someone personally that she's treated quite poorly as well.
Yeah.
And got nothing from the quote treatment that she was getting.
Yeah, and she is the go-to for the local parole person people. So
I mean, I can't give you any legal advice. I'm not an attorney, so
that's fine.
Take this, you know, as just a musing on my part. The state of Colorado does have something called the Department of Regulatory Agencies, and anybody can grieve anybody who's in the profession. And DORA, which is what we call it, takes all grievances seriously. So I don't know. You know, maybe there's something like that in your state.
We'll check into it for sure. Thank you.
I'm not advising you to grieve your counselor, but people have done such things. I can't say that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I noticed that Galen put a chat in here about what's the point? The point is compliance. That's absolutely correct.
Mm-hmm.
This is about corrections. It is not about counseling.
Yeah.
There is no corrections. There is no corrections in correction facilities. There's none.
Correction facilities. The correctional system. That's what this is all about. Correctional system.
The way they treat them when they're in these shadow prisons is even more ridiculous. They get like 4 hours a week of treatment in a place where they're intended to basically stay till they're dead. Nobody gets out of those things, and they get 4 hours of treatment. They're so dangerous. We can't let them out for the rest of their lives, but we only have 4 hours a week for them.
I noticed somebody said, how is it correctional? That's just the official term of the system. We're talking about the prison system. You know, the prison industrial complex, whatever you want to call
it.
The corrections is just the term. Well, that somebody wrote that in the chat. Now, that person Ken, who apparently didn't show up, sent me a couple of articles, and one was concerned with the involuntary commitment part. And that's somebody who they don't comply with their treatment and they wind up basically in for life to be, quote, treated. And I've worked in, you know, the deepest, darkest forensic units of state hospitals. And the people are in there because they are severely damaged. You know, they cannot function in the outside world, and some of them are just too dangerous to function in the outside world. That's different. You know, the people who are in there, sometimes they have ground privileges, like they can walk around in the area, but they can't leave the premises. But most of the people, they're going to live in that housing unit the rest of their lives. And I understood that. It made total sense to me. It wasn't like the system was coming down on people to be harsh. But involuntary commitment for somebody who committed a crime, that's a whole other story. That's just, again, it's out of some Russian existential novel. It doesn't make any sense other than punishment.
There are literally people in shadow prisons in both, I think it was Illinois and Minneapolis or Minnesota, who didn't actually ever commit a crime. They just went to their therapist and said, hey, I'm being attracted to my whatever, and I need some help. Hadn't touched the kid, hadn't done anything wrong, knew it was wrong, wanted to do better. And the therapist in the United States was turned them in to a shadow prison where they're going to live out the rest of their lives. The idea that we're helping, how could we even think we're helping? It's ridiculous.
I agree 100%. Yeah.
All right. I think Sandy already asked her question. I think that's the only hand. So why don't you finish your other half?
Okay. Now, this is going to be a more difficult presentation. So give me a moment. Let me get it set up so that I'm showing you the right thing. I got to get the right file here. Where is it? Bear with me. Sorry about that. Here we go. Okay. Now, remember, in addition to being an activist in this area, I'm also a psychotherapist. And I will tell you before I start, this is a provocative PowerPoint. I did this, I created this for the National Association of Addiction Professionals. And let me share it so that we're on the same page. All right, let me get this. Here we go. Can everybody see that okay? Okay. Obsessive sexual behavior and pornography viewing as addictions. Okay. That's my stand. Hold off until I'm through, but that is my stand. I've done some research on this. I've been working with people for a long time. Some people cannot help themselves what they do. They're addicted. Just as somebody who's on heroin is addicted or any other addiction. There is something called process addiction, and that's what we're dealing with here. So the ICD classifies, that's the World Health Organization's book. They don't use the DSM over there. The DSM is only used by the United States, Australia, and a couple other countries. The rest of the world uses the ICD, which is now edition 11, and that's published by the World Health Organization. And they classify compulsive sexual behavior as a mental health disorder. And in the ICD-11, compulsive sexual behavior disorder offers a formal diagnosis for the inability to control sexual behavior despite negative consequences. The World Health experts have agreed that compulsive sexual behavior disorder merits a diagnosis. And that may be controversial, but you know, let me tell you why I've taken this stand is it's a real thing. It's not stigma. It's not to make people out to be bad. There are people who, quote, can't help themselves, just as a heroin addict cannot help being in the throes of needing a fix. Now, can they have treatment? Yes, they can have treatment. But if it's not defined as a disorder, then it gets a little tricky. And especially if you're going to try to get insurance. It's not in the DSM. There's nothing like it in the DSM. The DSM isn't even considering it. And one of the reasons I'm making these presentations is to get the ball moving and to say, look, I'm not alone in this. There's a lot of people who are saying this. So now process addictions refers to behavioral problems that involve a lessening of control, persistent seeking after the behavior, and significant harm, even though no addictive substance is involved. And the DSM-5TR recognizes gambling as the only process addiction. And that one we could discuss endlessly right there. There's all kinds of other process addictions besides sexual behavior and pornography that should be in the book. Now, the DSM-5 considers paraphilic disorders, and that is a somewhat controversial notion, but it's a real thing. It's been in the DSM for a number of years. Do you see red marks across the string? I don't know why those happen, but there they are. Okay. We're going to have to deal with them. So now, the DSM talks about paraphilic disorders. They are not official diagnoses, so you can't get insurance to pay for treatment. And notice it has 8 classifications here. Do you understand these are classifications? Voyeuristic, that's observing an unsuspecting person naked or disrobing or engaging in sex. I don't know where all these lines are coming from. I have no idea. Fetishistic is arousal to non-living objects or a specific non-sexual part of the body. Exhibitionist, exposure to one's genitals to an unsuspecting stranger. Rotoristic.
Hey, Dr. Katz?
Yes?
Is your thing supposed to be going forward because it's stuck on the first page?
Do you see something that says paraphilic disorders?
No.
How about now?
We're still on that front page where there's a picture of peaches and a eggplant. And
So let me stop sharing and redo this. I don't know what happened. Something got frozen.
Because I'm a visual learner.
Okay. So this is showing me sharing a screen that has a book on the upper left and a book on the lower right.
Yep.
So notice paraphilic disorders. Those are in the DSM-5, but they're broken down in these categories, these 8 categories. So I stopped with sexual masochism. That's deriving sexual excitement from being humiliated, beaten, bound, or otherwise made to suffer. Sexual sadism, urges or fantasies of acts which psychological or physical suffering of a victim. Transvestic, which is urges and fantasies involving cross-dressing. Pedophilic, urges and fantasies involving sexual activities with prepubescent children. And other, such as telephone scatology, that means dirty phone calls. Necrophilia, zoophilia, having sex with animals, et cetera, et cetera. These are eight classes. And what I'm going to get to is there are actually hundreds of paraphilia. They are not considered diagnoses. They're under paraphilic disorders, which is kind of a fandom zone that's outside of the classification of diagnoses. Every diagnosis has a number put next to it. That's how you get paid from insurance if you have a diagnosis. If you have a paraphilic disorder, it's sort of a no man's land in a lot of ways. So notice these eight conditions. Now, these are people who have a compulsion. We're not talking about preferences. We're not talking about people who are curious and trying stuff out. These are people who are driven, just like people who have addictions to drugs. They are driven to some of these behaviors. Some of these behaviors are dangerous to other people, or at the very least are intrusive and invasive and involve humiliation or otherwise somehow impinging on other people. So let me make sure I can get to the next slide. Do you see another slide here? Okay, yes. So ASAC, which is a forward-thinking organization, does not find sufficient empirical evidence to support the classification of sex or porn addiction as a mental health disorder, and does not find the sexual addiction training, treatment methods, and education to be adequately informed by accurate human sexuality knowledge. And therefore, it is the position of ASAC that linking problems related to sexual urges, thoughts, or behaviors to porn, sexual addiction processes cannot be advanced by ASAC as a standard of practice for sexuality education, delivery, counseling, or therapy. Now, I have high respect for ASAC. It's a great organization. They're very forward-thinking. What's between the lines here is they don't want a bunch of this kind of, you know, scrutiny, say, on the kink community. You know, the people who are on the fringes, who are, you know, mutually doing stuff with each other that would be out of the norm. That's one of their big motivations in not wanting to support compulsive sexual behavior as a disorder. But they're pretty well locked in here. I'm trying to do a presentation there next year to make my point using this slideshow for one. Now we got SASH, the Society for the Advancement of Sexual Health. Having reviewed the available evidence, SASH is clear that there are several diagnostic models currently proposed and under investigation, all of which reflect an underlying clinical condition requiring dedicated assessment and treatment. Sexual addiction and pornography addiction are two such models. Additional models include hypersexual disorder, out-of-control sexual behavior, unspecified impulse control disorder, and sexual compulsivity, amongst others. A growing body of empirical evidence research supports the serious clinical concerns on which these various models seek intervention. So let's be clear about that. These have been studied. It's not like somebody's notion, oh yeah, let's throw that into the mix. Among this empirical evidence are dozens of studies supplying neuroscience evidence, that means brain scans and et cetera, consistent with the presence of addiction, primarily in internet pornography users, and also people who are addicted to games. People addicted to gaming have the same thing, you can see it in their brains, but also in sex addicts in general. There is research evidence also supporting other diagnostic labels such as hypersexual disorder, and that's from SASH. Now, be aware, until it's in the DSM, it's not official. It doesn't matter how many of these organizations, and there are a number of them that do. So I wanted to give you two organizations that are very highly thought of, very intelligent people. They would do fine in, you know, coming to a meeting like this. And they have two very different ideas. Meanwhile, the rest of the world, the ICD-11, it's already out there. It is a diagnosis, an official diagnosis with a number and everything. Okay, so the thing to think about, and I thought was germane to bring it to you all attention, is that there are some people who need help on the diagnostic clinical counseling level before they wind up crossing a line and getting arrested. And we have to be aware. We can't just say, well, they're like that. They just like that stuff. It's like, all right, well, I may like that stuff, but if it's an addiction, they can't help it. It's not a preference. It's not a choice they made. It's not like a bad decision. It's just like when somebody's in the throes of addiction, they're going to do it, no matter what the consequences. Okay. Now, let's just, there's nothing here that's illegal, by the way. I made sure of that. Mm-hmm. Pornography has been around as long as humans have created art. The word pornography derived from the Greek porne, prostitute, and graphein, to write, originally defined as any work of art or literature depicting the life of prostitutes, which has also been around forever. In America, pornography was outlawed from 1873 to 1957 under the Comstock Act, and prior, obscenity was only regulated on the state level since 1815. Roth versus the United States in 1957, which I'm old enough to remember, by the way, redefined obscenity, and pretty soon porn became accessible legally, except for pornography depicting children, which is still ill. Since then, the pornography business has flourished, y'all know. We're talking about multi-billion dollar operation. So, however proliferate porn became from the 50s to the 90s, pales in comparison to today with the internet. And by the way, these are simulated images, by the way. Those youngsters were from a bathing suit catalog. Whoops. In the United States, 66% of men, 41% of women consume pornography on a monthly basis. So we're talking about what are they doing every single day. An estimated 50% of all internet traffic is related to sex. Pornography is a mass phenomenon, influences our society. So this is from the Journal of the American Medical Association. About 200,000 Americans may be classified as porn addicts. What does that mean? They cannot stop viewing. They're not going to stop viewing. They're going to make sure that they make that time during the day to get on the web or pull out their collection, and they're going to view it, just like a drug user. 40 million American people regularly visit porn sites. 35% of all internet downloads related to pornography. One third of porn viewers are women. Every second, 37 pornographic videos are created in the U.S. 2.5 billion emails containing porn are sent to receive, and 68 million search queries related to pornography, 25% of total searches, and about 116,000 queries related to child pornography are received every second. So I want to be clear what my point is. This is not a moral judgment. This is a phenomenon that's occurring, and it's not being addressed as such. This is a problem for some people. I have no problem with pornography, or we can have a debate about child pornography, but I have no problem with people looking at naked pictures of other people, or sex acts, or whatever it is that they want to look at. But if they're hooked on it, we got a problem. Just as if they're hooked on heroin, that's a problem, and it affects all of us. There are currently some 1,500 dating sites and apps with just under 60 million users. And this is actually a little bit dated since I created this slideshow. So there are all these dating apps. What do you think is going on out there? You think all these people are looking for partners? No, they're looking for partners for the night. That's what's going on out there. So in addiction to the pornography, you got sex addicts, people who want to get laid all the time. It's not about love. It's not about connection. It's not about romance. It's not about looking for a perfect partner. It's looking to get off and get off with one another. That's why you have all these thousands of mating sites. Call them mating sites. Okay. So sexual fantasies, are there? Okay. We talked about paraphilias. Some of those are just fantasies. Nobody's ever going to do it with an animal, but they're going to think about it and they're going to obsess about it. So fantasies can be okay as a temporary escape from reality. You're just musing in your mind for an outlet to express, explore taboo desires, maybe with your partner or maybe with a consenting friend, to plan out or rehearse future sexual encounters, for relaxation or to cope with anxiety. It is not compulsive sexual behavior disorder unless it's obsessive, dangerous, and it interferes with one's actual life. So voyeurism. There are some people who that's their junk. That's their fix. They have to look in on other people. I'm working with a client now. That's why he called me. He realized it was, you know, a number of times he had been looking in on his neighbor's window. And in some states, that's a felony. You can get arrested for that. He knew it was a problem, and he called me, and we've been working on it. Fortunately, he was able to stay on this side of the law. Let's put it that way. But it was very close. And there's other behaviors that are related to that that he described to me, that like in airports. Airport behavior that was very tricky, but at least he had an awareness that something was going on that was problematic. And that's really what I'm, you know, trying to lobby for here. Obsessive public masturbation. Okay. I have another client who has a whole wide variety of ways of, and he gets away with it. He cut a hole in his pocket, so you can't really see what he's doing. So, and there's all kinds of people, male and female, who obsessively masturbate in public. Now, clearly, both of these things, if somebody gets caught, they're going to go through the system. Now, if we know if somebody in their family or friend or somebody or they themselves understand that this isn't good. Yeah, I get off on it, but I think about it all the time. I can't stop thinking about it. can they come in and get help? Maybe, you know, the counseling piece can prevent them from winding up in the system. Now, upskirting is something that has gained popularity over the past 10 years. It is now, well, it's a class 2 misdemeanor in Colorado. They just made it a felony in Utah and 4 other states. And that's a covert type of sexual voyeurism and abuse by using a camera or a mobile phone to take photos or videos underneath a person's clothes. People are hooked on this. It's not just, you know, we'll try it out. Won't that be fun? Okay. One of my earliest clients had just been busted. I told you I would keep working with them until the judge bangles the gavel. But he had just been busted and realized he needed help because he was hooked on doing this. He'd go into Walmart, he'd slide it under the door, and took all these pictures of women who were getting undressed in Walmart dressing room. So now once, you know, the judge bangs the gavel, I'm out of it. I'm not going to participate in that. So anyway, so this, I told you there are over 500 paraphilias. These are just some, you can just glance down the list. Some of these things are very dangerous. Now, if they're just a thought, that's one piece. So as a counselor, I would say if somebody's just thinking about it, they're obsessed about it in their mind, that's one kind of therapy. That's one kind of approach. But if somebody's going out to do it or making plans, some of these things are deadly and very dangerous and are problematic and should be addressed. So I'm going to stop sharing now. Now, you could look up paraphilias yourself, and you will see the hundreds of paraphilias that are out there. That was an abbreviated list, and I included some of the more dangerous, like getting off on seeing somebody bleed. You know, people having a sexual response to seeing somebody bleed. If you don't think that's dangerous, then let's have a debate about that. I think it's dangerous. I'd sure like that person to get some help. You know, as far as I'm concerned, the guy who's looking in on his neighbor's windows, I think his neighbors may have something to say about that, unless they like it, in which case, you know, maybe they're going to have a party. I don't know. But it is illegal. And the guy knows that. So he came to me knowing that he was, you know, one step ahead of, you know, the fact that he hadn't been busted yet was a miracle. Anyway,
I want to raise my own hand.
Okay, so somebody's asking, the diagnostic paraphilic disorder not otherwise specified of what, sex attraction to ghosts? Oh. I don't know. Something tells me that might be a safer one. I'm not sure. Unless they're deciding to make some ghosts. Then we got another story. See, somebody, it's a true paraphilia. I'm not talking about somebody has weird preference. A true paraphilia is like an obsession. That's what you got to get. That's why I'm talking about. We're not talking about strange preferences. We're talking about somebody who's driven. It's a process addiction. There's no drug involved, but the drug is their own. The ghost thing, was it? Ghost thing was on? Oh, that was on the list of paraphilias. Yeah. We could discuss that. Like I said, there's hundreds of them. Probably if you can imagine it, somebody's turned on by it. So, and it seems you got your hand raised.
I do have my hand raised. Yeah. So, you know, as I've been reading lots and lots of things, it seems like some countries and certainly some other types of citizens, I'm having a brain fart. Back in the day, you know, different communities, not just current day human beings, have had much better ideas about how to treat people with this kind of, you know, with disorders where they're attracted to kids. Do you know anything about like what fractured the universe? Obviously, the United States is pretty terrible, but how do we rate relative to other countries? Do you know that?
Well, this is something I would have talked about based on the two articles that were sent by Ken. Mm-hmm. And I'm willing to come back and discuss them because I think they're important. The thing to understand is that throughout history and still today in many countries, sex with children is no big deal. It's been part of humanity forever. As a therapist, I would say that doesn't make it okay. And we can have a debate about, well, then should there be laws about it and et cetera, et cetera. And I say, yeah, I think there should be laws about it. That's my opinion as a shrink, sure. Because I don't believe that children have the capacity and the agency to figure out their own sexuality until well past puberty. Now, some children may have a propensity earlier, and that's a possibility, and I could see that. And if they can make the choice, if they're truly making a choice, and it's just a little premature for most people, you know.
Well, the most recent one I remember reading about was can't remember, it seemed kind of like Sweden, some sort of place near Sweden. And they had for 12 to 17 year olds, if the 12 to 17 year olds had done something sexual, they didn't allow the parents to decide, this hurt my kid. They would actually ask the children, do you feel like this hurt you?
Yeah.
You know, was this a struggle for you? And if the kid was like, no, it's fine, they would not allow the parent to kind of override and turn it into a crime if the kid didn't consider it a crime. And, you know, I remember when I was 15 and 14 and 16, I definitely thought I was my own human being and that I got to decide who I kissed and who I thought was sexy. Yeah. So, you know, I know it's easy once you're an adult, once you're a parent, to say, oh, my kid is not allowed to think sexy thoughts yet because they're not quite old enough. But like, we were all teenagers and we all know that your brain decides when to turn that on for you.
My sense of it as a therapist, as a clinician, in addition to as a criminal justice dude, is I think there are different lines, certainly, when we come to teenagers, 13 to 17, let's say. Still illegal, but we could have a different debate there. But when we're talking about little kids, 6, 7, 8, I would just have a real hard time figuring what the justification would be to make that be okay. Even if the kid felt, oh, well, it was fun. Yeah, it felt, it was like, you didn't hurt me. I like Uncle Jack or whatever. Even if the kid was okay with it, I would just question what kind of effect that might have on the person going forward in terms of their development. And that's a discussion the other thing that have, you know.
Yeah, the other thing that I have read and think sounds pretty reasonable to me is, this was in Harmful to Minors. There's a whole section about, they interviewed a bunch of women from Bryn Mawr about all the sexual things they'd gone through in their lives, and had a wide range of, you know, we played prostitute, I played doctor with my cousin, I had sex with my brother, my uncle touched me, a whole wide range of things. And then they asked these women, like, how did this affect you? Do you need therapy? Are you still bothered by it? And so on. And they found that the main thing that determined whether the person was like really messed up about it was how the adults in their sphere reacted. If the adults in their sphere was like, oh, you know, a thing happened, you know, move on, it's fine, and didn't freak out and make it into a huge big deal and send somebody to the whatever, that the people tended to get past it. And I think about, you know, like if you got, let's say you got, what do they call it when someone tries to take your money? Mobbed. Mm-hmm. You got a, whatever they call that. You know, it's scary and you might worry about it for a while, but it doesn't, you know, because we don't treat it like you're, you know, this mess, now you're never going to be, you know, pure again. And, you know, if we don't turn it into a huge, awful thing, I feel like we would be better off. I think the world would be a little better off.
Well, I don't disagree with your premise there. What I'm talking about, again, I'm a person-centered practitioner. So I'm always going to be looking at what's the effect on the individual, not what society said or, you know, what they were told or any of that stuff. But I've worked with plenty of people who were victimized as children, and it isn't workable. They need help from that.
Sure.
So it was a traumatic event. It was not pleasant. I'm not saying that kids can't have fun and not come away with trauma. I mean, and have to come away with trauma. Am I making sense here? My concern is just that the propensity for trauma is probably higher with young children.
That's certainly true.
So I would, you know, just really question that, even though, again, throughout human history, it was never a thing. There were no laws. That's a relatively recent creation.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Well, we've gone 4 minutes over. I've had a very fascinating conversation. I've really enjoyed this whole conversation. You're obviously kind of someone that we'd like to talk to some more.
Oh, so, sure. I'm available. This is my third appearance here in the War Room, so
yeah.
I'll be glad to come back. What was the name of that book, by the way, with minors in the title?
Harmful to Minors.
Okay.
Judith Levine is the author, and I suggest everybody reads it. I find it really compelling. It just kind of let me change the way I thought about the world. So, like, I had a thing go down with a cousin every summer for a bunch of summers, and, you know, I just could put it away and came back to it later. And, you know, after reading that book, I'm like, he was only 3 years older than me. And it, like, I don't beat myself up about it. You know, when she says stuff like this has happened throughout the history of the universe, you know, I don't have to feel crappy about it. I just, you know, he was a child and I was a child and, you know, crazy stuff happened. And I no longer cause it to make me feel bad. So I just think, like, if that was the way the world looked at sexuality, just in general, that sexuality is a thing that everybody has, you know, sexuality. Sex mm-hmm. starts to come into all of our brains and it doesn't make you a bad person. I think we'd all be better off if we had a better way to look at that.
No disagreement here. I just want to be clear about one thing about why I brought up that second part of what I did. I thought it was germane to our discussion here because there are people out there who know they need help. They know they have compulsions that are not working for them. And I want to promote, you know, a healthier place for that to happen where it doesn't turn into a correctional situation, but it's more a therapeutic, helping, healing situation.
Absolutely.
So, anyway.
All right. Well, I love you guys all. Thank you for coming. And
thank you, everybody.
2 weeks from now, I can't remember who it is, but they're great. I'm sure they're great. Thank you, Dr. Katz. We really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. I'll be glad to come back.
All right. Chuck, can you remind us how you can save the chat if you want to save the chat? It's three dots. And then you go to the top one at save chat. So if anybody wants to just like be able to like get that email address of the guy that you want to contact or whatever, save chat is an option. Well, thank you, community. We'll see you in a couple of weeks. Oh, take our survey. We sent out a survey, I think yesterday. Take our survey. We're gathering information so we can be better, more awesome. Do your hand up. Hey, Galen.
Oh, you're so fast to unmute me. I was really impressed by tonight. Good job.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, he was great. It sounded, I mean, towards the end, he kind of veered a little into the, like, no, we do not need more shit in the DSM to warehouse people indefinitely in concrete cages as treatment. Like, no. But, Anne, who joined us, her last name, you called on her for a question. I forget her last name. It's a weird last name. Hyphenated. She's great. She's formerly incarcerated. She's in Maryland.
Jeannie.
She's really interested in mobilizing against the containment model in Maryland.
Mm.
And her partner was directly impacted. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, but hyphenated. It's like it's long. Anyway, she's really sharp, and she put a lot of comments in that I thought were very insightful. Mm-hmm. Also, I was happy to see that Karen Morrison came tonight.
Are you recommending that he might come back and be a speaker? Is that what you're considering, this Anne Bacini person?
I was actually thinking that she would be somebody that Women Against Registry might want to work with.
Yeah, I wrote her
in the world. Yeah.
I definitely wrote her name down and Karen's name down as like, ooh, I should be in touch with you.
Well, Karen's on our board.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's true. Well, but I just, and actually that when I started writing down her email, I was like, this is really familiar to me, but you're right. That's why.
Well, I mean, we use her warp email, but that's her like official email. So interestingly, I just got hired by a really influential group in DC. It's like a local group, though, not a national focus group. But it's sort of interesting because when you do local DC work, all of these, you know, professional lobbyist personalities are all here in DC. So they also pay attention to the DC criminal justice system because they're here in DC, right? So it has this sort of like drip down effect. Anyway, they're doing this like library of resources that they're authoring. So it's like new content that they're creating. And they wanted me to write their page on the registry. I was like, yeah, I'll do that. And they're like, we'll give you money. I'm like, well, I would have done it without money, but okay, with money is better. Yes, let's do that. So
congratulations. Anyway. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, no, that's good. Thank you for signing on to the Inclusive Democracy Act. So the reason I never got to call Chuck is I was on the phone with the lobbyist who is like one of the influential criminal justice people. And he just wouldn't stop talking about like, I can't hang up on him. And he's really interesting to talk to. He had some interesting ideas about the registry too. But I don't know. We'll have to say. So I was asking him, hey, how do we get more Black people interested in advocating against the registry? And I like walked him through all the talking points for why it disproportionately impacts African-Americans. And my question was, okay, like, how do we've tried to engage them? We've had Black people who care about this issue try to engage them, and it gets us nowhere at all. So, what do we do? And he basically suggested like a listening tour that we should like try to ask them. Like, we've kind of done that. I'm happy to do it again, but we've definitely tried that. And he's like, oh, well, it's not going to happen right away, and you've got to kind of stick with it. He sort of sounded like, you know how some of those child welfare people will talk about, like, you know, how you have to be like, be there for kids, and, you know, constantly, and they'll push you away, and you just have to keep staying there and being, it kind of sounded like that. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, well, they're going to reject you, and they're going to ignore you, and they're not going to care, but it really matters to them, and stick with it. And eventually they'll, like, you know, answer you.
Well, that is it's a really good question.
Well, it would be useful if we had, you know, more people of color that were involved. But
well, I mean, I think part of it probably just on the outside is, you know, our country has had such a long history of, you know, basically keeping people of color poor and, you know, undereducated, that the odds of people having the time to, like, poor people don't have extra time. And we've kept people of color poorer than everybody else for so long. Mm-hmm. They're probably just busy paying their bills, right?
I told him that argument, actually. And I the way I said it to him is, I had a conversation like a week ago, 2 weeks ago, with a rather prominent Black leader. And he said to me, we were talking about sex stuff, and he goes, well, you know, hey, while you're at it, could you like try to involve more Black people in your work? And I was like, yeah, about that. So we've tried. And like, when I started my group, we had a Black board member who was specifically doing outreach to the African-American community. And it got us nowhere. It got us crickets. And I think that Black people are already so marginalized that trying to get them, you know, and it's not just like, hey, I'm too busy or I'm too poor to do this. It's like, look, I'm already so screwed that I don't have the social capital to also advocate for the most marginalized people in our society. Like, that's just coverage too far for me. And he goes, oh, actually, that makes a lot of sense. I retract my request. Never mind.
No, it's true. Yeah. And you hear that same argument about other areas too. It's like, you know, white people want to save us and want to talk about it, but like, we're taking care of our own stuff, and we don't have time to make you guys feel better about helping Black people. Yeah.
Well, one of the things he said to me was that Black folks are, you know, like, very sensitive to the argument against throwing other people under the bus, and so they don't do that. And I didn't like push back on that, mostly because that was like one of his talking points in this like 10-minute diatribe that he was going into. But in my experience, all of the formerly incarcerated leaders who are throwing our population under the bus, and non-formerly incarcerated leaders too, they're all Black folk.
Mm-hmm. I would not say that was that's
no my, I don't think that's as well. That's a factual thing. But anyway, you must be exhausted. You did a great job.
I am exhausted.
I appreciate it. I'll sign off. I got
2.25 pages of that letter from prison typed today. I'm a really good typist. I didn't even realize how good a typist I am.
Wait, you can't OCR it?
I don't even know what that means.
I'm
older than you.
Optical character recognition, OCR.
Oh, yeah, I didn't look that up because I didn't know what it meant, and I don't know. I just started typing. I'm a pretty fast typist, but I'll look and see if I can find a fancy way to do it.
I mean, Chuck even has, like, a software that'll, like, read the...
Well, that would save me a lot of time. I'll stop. I was mostly able to, like, talk on the phone with Chuck while I did it, because I realized that, unlike almost every other thing, I could type and have a conversation with Chuck. No problem. I don't even know how that's true.
That's a weird. I can't.
I couldn't read it and talk to Chuck at the same time, but I could type it and talk to Chuck at the same time.
Oh, that's weird. Maybe it like short circuits that part of your brain that does the understanding.
Very strange.
The OCR software that I have It cannot do handwritten. It only does typewritten.
There definitely are OCRs that will do typewritten, though. I mean, handwritten.
It kind of depends on the handwritten. I mean, when I worked for MCR, we were taught to write in OCR font. So all of our handwriting was OCRable because we were taught exactly how to do the strokes and everything.
Interesting.
So that it would be 100% OCR. But this is not that. And I did run this through OCR once, and it got like maybe 5% of it. It was just horrible.
I'll just keep typing. It's good for me. It won't hurt me. I'll like watch TV while I'm typing. It'll be fine. So Galen and Chuck, we have that thing queued up to go out, but Chuck, how's your project on getting it to click straight to our website at the end?
Oh, it can't do it. Yeah, basically, I don't think Google Forms is usable. Google Forms,
so we got to redo it.
No logic, and you know, just nothing in there is very useful. So,
I'm
proposing redoing it in our form software that has all the conditional logic for everything.
I mean, look, next time, I think that makes sense and we can do that. I didn't even realize that we had form software. This time, I think we should just send it out. And we will send other appeals asking people to give money. And like, we'll make, you know, so that way the concern was that people that went to the form might not go back to the email. Okay, that's fine. So people that don't go back to the email, they'll get another email next week saying, please give us money. And we can use that cool countdown counter that you figure out how to do that shows the countdown until midnight on New Year's Eve, which is how much time they have left to give us money. And we'll do a separate email saying, oh my God, it's so cool that somebody gave us a matching gift. And, but we're not going to do that till 2 weeks from now. Wait, 1 week from when do we decide to do that? 2 weeks from now. 2 weeks from now.
I don't remember.
Yeah, the middle of the month. Like, we'll do it halfway through the month.
Okay.
So I say that we just get this thing out because it's going to be the 6th and we wanted to start the campaign on the 1st.
Well, so, you told me about it on the 1st. That doesn't mean it's going to, if I have to make a survey and make the survey link to a website and type the thing and go through all of your criticisms about it, like that's a lot of things.
In my defense, I did bring up the survey like in the middle of last month.
Well, that doesn't mean it got made. I do things every day, all day. Like it's a busy day.
I know.
All right,
guys.
And actually, I did start making a survey last month, but you said you were going to make a survey last month.
I like the survey. I think it's a good survey. I think the cell phone number part's important. I think more people.
Chuck has a problem with the cell phone number part. Something bad is happening.
Chuck, they need to tell us their fucking number.
No, it was set to a 7-digit number. It would not accept an area code. So I had to go in and fix the regular expression.
Oh, but you fixed it? Because I know how to do that too if you need it.
Yeah, I fixed the regular expression. And then as I went through other parts of it, there were other errors. And it got so, there were just too many errors. It's easier to create it in the right software than to fix all the errors. So I say no to the Google form.
All right. So did you recreate it then?
You started it, but I didn't get it back till
this meeting to attend. So, no, I didn't finish it.
But it's supposed to go out tomorrow.
It can go out when it's ready.
One more day. Will one more day kill us?
All right. Well, Chuck, why don't we just get it out tomorrow and whenever it's ready? So instead of waiting for the magic optimal fairy dust time to send out the email, let's just send it out.
All right. When it's ready, it can go out.
Okay. Tomorrow. When it's ready tomorrow.
I gotta go hang out with
Saturday.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Oh my.